Hello and welcome to another episode of Unofficial Partner, the sports business podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Kim Skildham-Reed is one of the most influential voices in sponsorship across the Asia-Pacific region. She founded Power Sponsorship in Sydney in 1994 to provide strategic advice to major corporate sponsors in that part of the world. And the company's roll call of clients have included some of sport's biggest spenders, such as Unilever, Qantas, SAB Miller, QBE, and the Singapore government, among many others. So the topic of the conversation today is the state of the sponsorship market, the difference between good and bad strategy, and the short and long-term impact of the COVID crisis on brands' perception of sport as a marketing platform. I've got a question for you. I remember you doing a presentation at ESSA in London a few years ago, and I just want you to, first of all, position you. What we know you as a sponsorship consultant.
Right.
Now, what does that mean? Because that has many sort of guises. And I just want you to just say, what is it that your clients want? And where do you sort of play in the whole spectrum of, you know, this sports marketing game?
All right. So I work in sponsorship, not sports marketing. I mean, there's a lot of sports sponsorship that I work on, but I'm not, you know, strictly just in sports. So whatever it is that my clients are doing, that's what I'm doing. I don't do any sponsorship brokering, so I'm not an agency in any way. I don't sell on behalf of anybody else. I work primarily with major sponsors and government that are acting as corporate sponsors. They're spending the money. And I work with them strictly on a strategic basis. So I don't do any implementation at all. It's all about strategy work, reviews, and capacity building. I do the same for some larger rights holders. So I only work with them in a strategic or capacity building way. So sort of very much the thin edge of the wedge. I do a lot of speaking, in-house training, strategy sessions. I'm fully booked out till the end of the year on strategies right now. So, it's been all of a sudden very busy.
So everyone, you go in, tell them what to do, and then someone else does it.
Correct.
That's a nice position to be in.
I teach them how to do it. I support them with coaching and all of that for months or years afterwards. But I'm not the one running around at events telling people where to go, and I'm not I'm not hiring subcontractors and activation agencies and that kind of thing at all.
So that's the good bit. You like sort of give them the PowerPoint, and it's a nice position to be in. You know, you're not getting your hands dirty.
I used to love getting my hands dirty. When I was first in this industry, I was the one with the clipboard bossing people around, and I loved it. But my gosh, it's a lot of work for not very much pay back then.
So let's talk about the sort of state of the market. So if you're, the obvious COVID question is hanging over this, but we'll just pause on that for a minute. But what is the difference between you and other consultants in that world? Because again, when I'm looking at from the client side and they're saying, well, okay, and we'll keep the conversation to sport just for the context of it.
That's
but if they're saying, okay, we want to get into, or we want to do this, and this is our objectives, why do they pick you?
Well, they pick me because number one is that I don't have a dog in the fight. If they hire an activation agency or somebody else that's more full service, they're going to be giving them advice that dovetails with the actual implementation. So I can be really objective as to which direction I think they should go into, because I'm not looking for making any more money off the back of it in implementation. The other thing is that I've got a pretty strong reputation for just being really straightforward and not being sort of a yes person. And the senior executives that hire me appreciate that I'm not going to blow sunshine up anybody's skirt.
The The senior thing is interesting. I always find the sponsorship decision-making process, we talk, and you know, for years people have said it's the chairman's whim or the whatever the, you know, the CEO's whim around sponsorship. There is that personalization of the decision-making process. And then there is also the, or it needs the buy-in of the, you know, top table of decision makers. And I always think there's a very thin line between those two. One sounds good, the latter one, okay, obviously you need buy-in from the senior team. And the other one is a sort of, oh, it's just a personal hobby and, you know, they get into cricket, football, the Olympics because they want, because the person at the top likes it. And obviously those are both two, you know, that's an extreme characterization, but it's interesting how often that lingers. And I'm just wondering about your, how you talk to people at the sort of top end of a big organization about sponsorship.
Well, I first off, I think that the chairman's choice type of sponsorships are fading just because of the accountability around sponsorship these days. There's so much measurement and stuff, even if the measurement isn't great, there's so much measurement around sponsorship happening now and so much accountability that, you know, senior executives, they still have to answer to the board for why they spent X millions of dollars on some football team.
But isn't there just so, sorry to interrupt, but isn't there a sort of, the next bit of this is, all the data is saying the same thing, and it's the maverick thing to do is to make a personal choice. This is the sort of, you know, this is the exciting, thrilling, counterintuitive decision, and we're gonna go with gut. The return of gut is going to be a sort of an instinct over the sort of tedious data spreadsheet decision making process.
Well, I think that the decision needs to be a balance of the tedious analytic spreadsheet sort of thing and creating a vision for what it means for your company, for your brand, for your target markets, your segments. And so it's a balance of that kind of stuff. And some of that does, if you do the right analysis, whoa, sorry, I live near the airport. Can you hear that?
Just about, yeah. It's okay, you know. Right. Noise is off, are good.
Although I got to say, it's a lot quieter here than it used to be.
It adds authenticity to a podcast. You see, that's why we like it.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, yeah, so like the. I live in the extremely cool inner west of Sydney, except for the airport is the downside. So apologies for that. I don't remember where I was now.
So we were talking about, is instinct going to come back? Because there's a sort of reaction against data-driven decision-making. One is because it's sort of, it doesn't feel human, and the human element of decision-making is important. And I think there's a sort of, I sense that a next generation of leaders, business leaders, in the same way as political leaders have sort of, seen that actually talking like a human being is useful, both good and bad. Do you think that the whole data question is going to be put under, is just going to be sort of, yeah, that's just hygiene, but we'll make the decision anyway?
You know, I think that there is a big shift with the whole disruptive marketing thing, which sponsorship does better than any other kind of marketing. It's all built around the idea of design thinking, which is about analysis and then crazy amounts of creativity. And the analysis isn't about crunching numbers. The analysis is actually about developing empathy. So it is about humans and it's not about numbers. And so that's where I'm going with my clients these days, is really thinking about, you know, rather than spreadsheets. I mean, you do need to get some degree of background information to at least get a grounding, but the most important background information that you can get before you make a decision as a company is, why do people care about these things? What is their relationship with it? You know, how deep is their passion? You know, what are they willing to do for it? And that kind of stuff. And what's their experience like? And what is it like to be a fan? What's it like to be a fan right now in COVID? And all of those things start from the very human side, the very empathetic side. So rather than just going out and being like, you know, saying, I'm such a badass, look at this decision I made, you know, it's totally counterintuitive. you can actually do something really human-centric that isn't about crunching numbers, but is still really strategic.
And are you ever surprised by the research that you see before you, you know, and what's the last time, what's the bits that you look for when people come to you and say, okay, look, we're looking at this?
Well, I'm always amazed when I look at brand tracking, how much stuff that they track that they don't really care about, that doesn't come up anywhere. And rather than diving deep on the stuff that's really important, they ask like 120 questions, about 80 of which have nothing to do with their goals. And so, so I'm kind of shocked sometimes at how shallow the research is. But the stuff that I really look for in research is you know, the things like trust and the perceptions and all those basic things about their relationship to the brand and the advocacy. But I also look at, I'm very much like personas in terms of what drives their decisions and what motivates, you know, what motivates them and how they define themselves. And those are all things that you can really use with sponsorship.
By personas, what do you mean? Do you mean audience personas?
Yeah, but you know, there's all this sort of Helix stuff, which is, you know, sort of dozens of different ready to go personas, and saying, oh yes, we target persona A and persona F and persona H. And I don't like that nearly as well as when brands actually do their own personas and say, this is why somebody would choose to buy electricity from us, or to bank with us, or to drive our cars, or to, you know, or to use our games, and really drills deep, and where they've actually done the diligence, where they've actually tried to be empathetic to the people that are having a brand experience, as opposed to just kind of trying to figure out which pigeonhole their people are fitting into.
But those sort of personality, or the, you know, the profiling of customers, essentially they're sort of stereotype machines, aren't they? They're just generating a face upon which you put a sort of a cliche, and then a sports, you know, if you're moving into rugby, the brand is wanting to buy the stereotype in a way, aren't they? They're saying, right, okay, we're going to go to rugby, we're going to go upmarket, posh male, and away we go. They don't really want accuracy in that process, don't they? That's why they'll go for a sort of TGI type.
What you've just described there is demographic. It has nothing to do with the actual personas, the motivations, and the psychographics. You know, it's like, why does this upmarket posh guy care? And there's easily four different segments, psychographic segments, of why any given guy or woman would love the rugby. And they have nothing to do with socioeconomics, and they have nothing to do with you know, with their gender or anything else. It literally, and that's the stuff, those motivations, that's what a sponsor can use, not the fact that this guy's got some dosh in his pocket and he likes the rugby.
And where do you find that stuff? Because do the rights holders have that research?
Well, the rights holders should have that research, but unfortunately they keep investing in like these bloody dinosaur, you know, visibility reports that, oh lordy. I wish the metaphoric meteor would come and wipe those things off the planet. But they don't. They don't actually understand what drives their markets. And with, for the segment of sports organizations that do understand that, they don't share it with their sponsors. They use that to market their team or their sport or whatever. And they don't share that with their sponsors, so their sponsors can get in on that, you know, gold mine of empathy and use it for their brand.
But they are locked out. I mean, so this is part of the sort of the data conversation, isn't it? And the, you know, the digital transformation conversation, which is just the sort of that there are the tech giants have got all the information. There's a walled garden around that data. They're not going to let anyone else have it. That's the value of the company. The sports are trying to go direct to fans to try and replicate in some way the sort of information that they're getting from fans, but they're not actually capable of doing it because it's a sort of enormous and a very expensive task, and culturally and not just a different.
But if you attack it from a sheer, you know, from a sheer data point of view, and this is where, you know, we're kind of circling back to that, you know, the person that's making a decision based on gut rather than data. And it's not really that, but it's basically saying, look, you can crunch, you know, tens of millions of people worth of data through some, you know, some filter system and come up with a bunch of people and you can micro-target them. I mean, you can do that. But it doesn't actually get to the heart of the passion that these people have. And if somebody is really involved in a, you know, in a soccer club, in a, you know, in an Aussie rules club down here or whatever, you know, they'll say, you know, there's people that are here and they're motivated by their total love of the team. And then there are people here that just want to go out drinking with their mates, and their excuse is that it's a, you know, it's a game day. And that's just like the centerpiece of a bigger day. And there's people that love the tribal atmosphere. I mean, that's me at the Sydney Swans. I'm a tribal, no question about it. I love singing the song and swinging around the scarf and all that. And if the stands aren't full, I got to tell you, I'm quite happy to sit on the couch and watch it rather than be in a quarter full stadium, because it just doesn't push my buttons. And so there's a bunch of different reasons that sponsors can use to actually connect with people and actually align with people. And the rights holders know these reasons, but if they keep turning towards, oh, what data can we crunch against other data, they're not going to actually get into the passion that people have. Like they're letting the data cloud up their thinking of who these people are, because they are people. They're not, you know, they're not zeros and ones.
So let's talk then. You talked about the, you know, why people are doing it and passion and all those. Right. Words. We're hovering around. So brand purpose. Let's talk about that for a moment. Does anyone care what a sort of electricity company or a bank or a car company feels and does? And is the why been overplayed?
I think that more and more people do. And it might not be their core purpose, which drives why they do what they do. That might drive their staff and everything. But people that are millennials and younger are more and more and more trying to look for, looking for brands and giving their love to brands that stand for something. Like it's literally better to alienate some people and deepen your love with others rather than to try to be Switzerland and stand for nothing. That is reflective of their purpose, even though they might, you know, the power company might say something like, we want everybody to have green electricity and that is our purpose. That may or may not be a realistic thing to attach a sponsorship to, but there is probably other parts of the brand that are genuine facets of the brand that would be legitimate to attach a sponsorship to and would really reflect who they are. I mean, Nike with Colin Kaepernick, you know, Every Town for Gun Control with Levi's. I mean, these are incredibly polarizing decisions, but they did it knowing that that they'd alienate some people. But Levi's in particular was really canny, because Levi's had at best agnostic, you know, sort of feeling with millennials and Gen Z. And all of a sudden they're giving $1 million US a year to Every Town for Gun Control, which is this huge issue in that age group. And suddenly they're stuck with their next generations of customers has risen astronomically.
Do you think it's very category specific, that argument?
I don't think it needs to be. I mean, there are plenty of categories that have made those kind of statements. A lot of those statements, frankly, have been made in America, where there are so many polarizing issues. I mean, like, I can think of 10 issues off the top of my head in America that would be more polarizing than the most polarizing thing in Australia.
Talked to David Weldon recently, and one of the questions, the things that we talked about around brand purpose is when you start, if that's the core of your, you know, that's where you're starting from the strategy. If you're starting, you know, with why or whatever Simon Sinek's, mm-hmm. you know, the book is, it's quite hard to make entertaining. And actually you end up the sort of execution of that strategy is quite dull And it's quite hard to make it funny, entertaining, irreverent if you're starting with quite a sort of worthy position.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And that is where I'm saying that, you know, it's sort of like, it's great to have a purpose that drives what you do and drives the sort of the mission of your team internally. But when it comes right down to it, I mean, marketing is only really about one thing. Like, there's only one mission to marketing, and that is to be the natural choice for your target markets. And in order to do that, you have to reflect what they are and who they are and what they need and be empathetic to them if you want to actually become the natural choice for them. So, you know, so the I think that your purpose that drives you internally and what makes you meaningful to your target markets, there's probably a thread between them, but they don't need to be the same thing, because you're right. What drives a company internally is often very difficult to enunciate in a marketing way, in a way that is really compelling and exciting and will grab people in such a cluttered space.
Okay, let's talk about COVID then, inevitably. What has changed, you think, over the last few months? And there's a forward-looking question to this, but just at the moment, what are clients talking about? What's the sort of nature of the conversation?
How can we get more returns with 30% less budget? Or, oh my God, I'm in multi-year contracts that I can't reduce my spend on rights fees because I'm in these multi-year contracts. But now I've had my now my leverage money is cut to 10% of what it was. What do we do? So, I mean, right now, it's all about rationalizing. It's about rationalizing and trying to do fewer things, do them way better, so that they don't lose out on the results, but they have to spend less money. I mean, I've got clients in America like that. I've got a client in New Zealand like that. I've got two clients here that are like that. They're all, and people are contacting me to do not only strategies, but portfolio reviews. I've got, as I said, I'm like booked out until at least Christmas at this point, doing exactly that.
So telling them where to cut.
Well, yeah. I mean, and trying to stop them from cutting some of the things that aren't there, that are really good for their brands, but might not be the most obvious ones to keep. You know, sort of like, no, don't cut that. That's a multi-tool. You can use that in a million different ways because it is so relevant, even though it's not as sexy as this thing over here. Get rid of that sexy thing that's costing you a fortune because it's not as flexible and powerful if you do it right. So it's trying to shepherd them into getting the most power for the least amount of money and using internal buy-in and creativity to maximize every single dollar they spend.
So agencies are going to suffer in the, well, short and medium term, aren't they, presumably?
Yeah, agencies are going to suffer. Rights holders are really, really going to suffer. This is going to be super hard for rights holders.
And is there any advice for rights holders in terms of, obviously they just, you know, they want to sell rights and they want to make money. That's a given. But short term, what can they do to make themselves, to get their foot in the door with brands when brands are saying, right, okay, I just want to cut less and get out of this contract?
I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that they can do, but most of it really comes down to, it's like, all right, you know, you might have been toying around the edge of best practice and this whole empathy stuff and you know, doing the segmentation and customizing proposals and feeding them with amazing leverage ideas that don't cost very much money. You might have been playing around the edges with that before, but now you have to do it. You have no choice. You've got none. There is going to be so much competition for a dwindling pool of cash, and sponsors are not only looking to cut the money, they're looking to do it better. So if you continue to phone it in or use old school techniques, you're bloody not going to sell anything right now. Like, the bar has got higher while the pool of money has gotten smaller simultaneously.
Presumably there's a, you know, for and I get that, I understand that what you're saying. There are brands spending money though. I mean, it's interesting, yeah. You know, around in certain areas, in certain spots, and bit of that presumably is, well, it's cheap and it's a good time to invest in it, you know, and you go and find bargains. And the other bit is that this, again, is this impact is different across different categories. And there's always, on the rights holder side, this endless search for new categories of sponsors, yep. obviously. Is that market by market? You cover a lot of different markets, as I say, the States, Australia. Is it different market by market, or is it pretty much the same?
I think that the markets are a little bit different from each other. I mean, I think that everybody's cutting back right now. I think that the US is doing it tougher, and the rights holders over there are really going to do it tougher. You know, I think that it looks like, and you know, who has a crystal ball at this point, but it looks like the recession is probably going to be longer and deeper there than a lot of other places in the world. Yeah, not an economist, but I've been trying to keep track of this stuff. And so I think there's plenty of people over in the US that are in this industry that are kind of shitting themselves, frankly. So sorry.
So we've got one of those very fashionable things on iTunes that says that we are, you know, they're swearing will take place. There was adult content or whatever.
All right, sorry. So, well, there you go. You can next week it'll be 28 years I've been in Australia, and my mother is just incredibly appalled at how my language has changed. I'm no longer a nice, polite Minnesotan.
One response might be to go the sort of put a lot of money into the performance marketing end of your, you know, budget. So if you're looking at a sponsorship and you've got, it's famously, you know, we all, the whole industry says, oh, it's the answer to all ills sometimes, you know, it's top of funnel, bottom of funnel, blah, blah, blah. And we get that. And that's, you know, the audience for this podcast knows those arguments very well. And one obvious place to go would be, okay, well, let's make this sponsorship work harder, inverted mm-hmm. commas, and let's go and right down into the weeds and start to use it to push out on the performance end of the funnel. What are the implications of that? Because is that that's a good strategy, but does it make sponsors look small? I mean, I'm just wondering, there's a sponsorship as sort of, there's the big picture stuff that quite often gets lost when you go the performance route. Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I guess
it's brand versus business argument.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you look at that and you do see some of that sort of cropping up here and there, and certainly I've been doing some intake interviews for a new client and some of the people on the sort of new client acquisition, new customer acquisition side are very much in the what's called what would be second generation sponsorship, which is, you know, I want to spend some money on sponsorship and I want to know exactly how much profit I have made off of every sale that has come from that sponsorship. And so it's a really incredibly narrow view of what sponsorship can do. And it's legitimate. I mean, it's legitimate to be using sponsorship in that way where it's where it is directly pushing sales. But if you're only doing that, you might as well just bloody, you know, spend your money on Facebook and bloody just micro target or something. I mean, really, you are completely missing all the beauty of sponsorship in that its flexibility and its personal relevance and the passion and the meaning. And so go ahead and do that stuff, but don't miss everything else. That really is, as you just said, like, you know, sort of making it super, super small and narrow.
Longer term, do you think there's an impact? Do you think that, you know, when CMOs now look at sport sponsorship and they look at empty stadiums and they look at the, you know, what they were going to buy 6 months ago compared to what you're actually getting now in terms of just the heat around sport, and obviously big sport will always generate eyeballs on media, that's one argument, so there will always be that media return in certain, you know, to certain degrees. But do you think that, okay, there's going to be a generation of CMOs who say, yeah, we're going to dip out of sport for a while here, we'll go and do something else while it, you know, and then the crowds will come back and then we'll come back and look at it again? That's the worry, isn't it? There's a longer term impact on decision making.
I'm not worried about that. I'm not. I'm really not. I think that the mid to longer term impact of what's going on right now with pandemic and recession and all of that is actually going to be really good for our industry, which is not to diminish the fact that this is really flipping hard right now for everybody in the industry is kind of, is kind of suffering in their own ways. But what's going on with the, you know, empty stadiums or the quarter full stadiums or what have you, is making the rights holders, the sporting organizations, it's forcing them to focus on the remote fans. And I've been harping on for years about don't forget the remote fans. You got to remember the remote fans, add value to the remote fan experience. And this is like, okay, well, now there's no choice because you have to, because there is no real fans. So they're not in the stadium anymore. So all those flashy, expensive on-site activations where people are in like VR goggles and all that crap, you know, that's not going to happen. So now you really do need to learn how to scale it to the remote fans. So the what I saw initially happening in the sports industry was that the sports organizations themselves did a really nice pivot and started talking to their remote fans and were really engaging with them. And I'm using engaging. And if you could see me, I'm doing air quotes. engaging with their fans, but they were keeping all the best ideas for themselves and they weren't flicking any ideas at all to the sponsors. And the sponsors were just kind of going, okay, now what are we supposed to do here? And watching, you know, the sport do cool things, but not involving any of them. And so at this point, the sport needs to translate that remote fan sort of expertise that they're building. And some sports have had that, but a lot of sports really don't pay attention to it. Like they don't pay attention to anybody that's not going to eventually pay them for something, merchandise or tickets or something. But sponsors particularly are going to learn how to value the remote fans. And that's actually going to, in the long run, increase the value of sporting sponsorships. Now, I'm not saying the next couple of years, because the next couple of years is going to be hard. But from there, because all of a sudden, sponsors and rights holders are going to be looking and saying, okay, well, this is how many people we got bums on seats. But these are the people that really care about us. This is why they care. These are the reasons that they care and what why this has meaning to them and why they share it with their friends and families and all of that kind of stuff. And here is how we can get you involved in that sponsors. And so they're not talking about, you know, this is how many season ticket holders we have or memberships or bums on seats. They're talking about people who care. Because even if those people will never, ever add to the bottom line directly with merchandise or tickets or what have you for that sporting organization, those are infinitely leverageable for sponsors. So they're going to have, you know, longer leverage periods and more leverage opportunities and more multifaceted ways to connect with people and align with them. I think this is going to be good in the long term.
You've been in sponsorship a while now, a long time. How many years?
30-ish, 30, like I left uni when I was 20. And then, yeah, so yeah.
Well, I guess the question is, do sports fans care about sponsors? How much evidence have you sort of seen in your career that of that impact that you that a sponsor has in, you know, made some sort of impact on a fan? Because normally they're just seen as a sort of a necessary evil.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are some sports and some sponsors that have got it down to an art form, but the whole thing is like, you know, it comes down to the very simple question, which is, has the sponsor made the fan experience better? Like, have they actually improved my fan experience in a meaningful way? And if they haven't, then it's just wallpaper. Because nobody goes in like, you know, I've already mentioned the Sydney Swans, my favorite team in the world, and that is saying something. But as much as I love them, and I really do, and I'm in this industry, so I pay more attention than to anybody else, I don't go into the stadium taking note of all the sponsors so I can transfer my love to them. I mean, nobody does that. And yet that's how so many sponsorships have been bought and sold. So you know, that if you see the logo and it's on the stadium where your team is playing and you love the team, then people will love you because you're next to the people that they love. And it's like, oh, for God's sakes. So I think that fans appreciate and fall in love with the brands that actually act like fans, the ones that add meaningful value, like they get what the value is and they spread that love around. So it's not one person winning something or 100 people out of the 60,000 that fit in the stadium that get to do the VR experience or whatever, that they're just the sponsors that are thinking about them all the time in lots of ways become part of the fabric of the experience. And you don't see enough of that now. Well, you didn't see enough of that pre-COVID. And I think that as sponsors and rights holders get better at this remote fan thing, that you're going to see more of that. That there's going to be more added value, not only to an in-person experience, which frankly can get, you know, cluttered and loud and intrusive at some points, but also to the remote fan experience.
There's a sort of, how long do you think it takes for a sponsor to be noticed by fans that they're having some, you know, that they're involved in a sponsorship relationship?
Well, it depends on how bloody creative and meaningful that they're willing to be with their leverage. I mean, if they just sit around, smack their logos on things and wait for people to name them prompted or unprompted in some exit survey, well, it's going to take them a bloody long time. You know, I mean, it's just wallpaper. But if they literally go into it using design thinking with empathy for the fan experience, understand the fan experience, add value to that fan experience, they can supercharge how fast people are on board and aligning with them. I mean, this is Air New Zealand with the All Blacks. You know, it's like people think of it, Kiwis think of the of Air New Zealand as like-minded. You know, I mean, this is this huge international company in New Zealand, and Kiwis, because Air New Zealand always talks like a fan. They always do stuff that's meaningful. They scale things so that it creates wins for tons of people rather than just one or two. And or 100, and because of that, and because they do that with every single thing that they sponsor, people believe that Air New Zealand is like-minded. I mean, nobody in Australia thinks that Qantas is like-minded. I mean, and they're on the bloody front of the Wallabies.
So what you're saying there in terms of being like-minded, that the values of the All Blacks have transferred over time to the perception of people's perception of Air New Zealand?
No, I'm not saying that at all. And in fact, I'm not a big believer in that whole image transfer thing. I mean, it has to be something that, you know, I don't think that a rights holder can imbue traits onto a sponsor that they don't legitimately already have. So it can enhance stuff. But it really is that Air New Zealand has gone into this whole thing thinking, we're not going to sponsor the All Blacks, we're going to sponsor the fans. And that's what they do. I mean, the best sponsors in the world that are getting the most traction the fastest with their sports sponsorships are the ones that go in and did they do a contract with the rights holder? But their entire attitude is, we're not sponsoring the organization, we're sponsoring the fans. And as soon as you pivot your thinking to that, the entire way that you leverage changes. And so Kiwis, it isn't like Air New Zealand sponsors the All Blacks and isn't that wonderful, and they've got black and white planes and they got black and white uniforms and how cool is that, and they all look the same. It isn't like that at all. It's literally that they believe that Air New Zealand gets it and they love the All Blacks just like they do. Not that they paid the money, not that they're next to them, not that they borrowed the imagery and all of that, but they are as one-eyed and passionate. I mean, you know, for the people out there in podcast land, follow Air New Zealand for a couple of weeks on Facebook and Instagram, just because it will be a masterclass on having the voice of a fan. And that makes all the difference. And you can check out Qantas with the Wallabies and compare and contrast, because they sound like, you know, all their statements sound like they are 2 months out of date and got regurgitated through about six different committees before they ended up on Twitter.
It's sort of the sound like a fan thing is interesting. I encourage everyone to do this, and you know, let's go and compare New Zealand and Qantas. It'll be quite interesting. we'll do that en masse. I can think of examples where sponsors trying to ingratiate with me in a sort of chummy way as a fellow fan really gets on my nerves sometimes. You know, you get sort of I quite often think of bottled water is getting quite sort of opinionated. You know, it's sort of just coming in and bantering and jumping into my Twitter timeline and doing all sort of, oh, sort of, you know.
If it's disingenuous, I mean, a fan can see that a million miles away. All you got to do is look at esports for that. I mean, those fans literally, I mean, they will just eviscerate a sponsor that isn't genuine.
Maybe. Right. One tip for the future then, Kim. I just want, before I let you go, what's going to happen? Just give me a sort of something, one thing to cling on to. What hope have we got in this sort of COVID nightmare?
Look, I mean, I'm actually pretty positive for the future, but I think that this is going to shake out a lot of organizations that have been phoning in sponsorship for a long time. And particularly rights holders. I mean, there are going to be rights holders that are just going to have to learn how to get other kinds of income if they can't commit the time, the effort, the resources to doing sponsorship right, because there just isn't going to be any other, you know, sort of option going forward.
But they are an easy hit, aren't they? I always feel a bit sorry for rights holders, because I always think very easy to say, you know, and say, well, okay, it's the rights holders' fault. They don't understand me. They haven't got the team. They can't support. But actually, these organizations are quite small compared to the size of the sponsors. So it is unrealistic for them, to the expectations that we're putting on rights holders, to become like sort of a bit like Amazon, a bit like, you know, Walmart, or a bit like Nike, and rethink and sport as entertainment, and all of these things that are on their agenda. And when they don't do it perfectly, it's quite easy for brand people to say, oh yeah, well, it was the rights holders' fault.
You know what? I don't think that rights holders get to phone it in. I mean, I get it that they're small, but if they don't understand their own audience, then for God's sakes, I mean, then they wouldn't get any bums on seats. What they need to do is feed that information through to sponsors, and then they need to feed them through the ideas for leverage that are going to be meaningful to these people. I mean, this really isn't rocket science. This is not a huge expectation. I get that these are small organizations, but these are threshold needs for just being the organizations that they are.
You can't be a sponsorship strategist and say it's not rocket science. That's the whole point. But you're shielded. You don't hear a lawyer say that. You need to build value into, you know, what the strategy is. You can't give away that sort of. You can't give it away that easily. Of course, it's rocket science.
I mean, I write all these blogs, I write books, and all this kind of stuff, and it's not that complicated. The hardest part of the whole thing is letting go of the old way of doing it and then getting the rest of your organization to do the same. That's the hardest part, because as soon as you do that, you kind of look at best practice and go, oh yeah, hell, that makes a lot of sense. Why have we not been doing it like that? And sponsors are the same. It's like, you know, the hardest part to getting to that best practice where you're really creating some amazing results for all parties, including the fans, you know, really the first step to it is letting go of all those old habits. And once you do, it's not difficult. It makes so much more sense to do best practice than to explain this whole, well, you know, this love transfer thing and being on something and people will see your logo and maybe that's going to make you front of mind and, oh, spare me. You know?
That's our headline. Oh, spare me. That's like a right, Kim. Thank you very much for your time. I'd love to get you back on at some point. We'll talk more specifically about the sponsorship market and different deals and things. I've got a plan for a sponsorship series. But in the meantime, thanks very much for your time. You enjoyed it.
No worries, my pleasure.